This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Next week, the Federal Communications Commission is scheduled to vote on new rules that would continue a trend towards deregulation of broadcast media. Many proponents point to radio and argue that the radio industry has profited greatly from the relaxation of government controls going back to the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Opponents point to radio, too. They say deregulation has made radio less diverse, less local, less of a public service, and more of a franchised commodity. But rules aren't the only factor driving change in radio. Technology allows an announcer in Dallas to host local programs that air in Minneapolis and Milwaukee and Miami. But technology also offers satellite radio and the promise of digital. This hour, we'll take a look at how looser FCC rules and developing technology affect radio. Also, what happened to the idea that radio stations got these airwaves as long as they served the public? Do they still do that? Should they? Of course, National Public Radio and its member stations have a stake in all of this. We're going to focus on commercial radio for most of this program. Later, we will also address issues specific to non-commercial broadcasting. Join the conversation. How does radio sound different to you than it did, say, 10 years ago or 20? Are you hearing the songs that you want to hear? Can you depend on commercial radio to introduce you to new bands? And what should radio be for? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us now from just outside of Philadelphia is David Field, the president and CEO of Entercom, a company that owns and operates 102 stations in 19 markets nationwide. And it's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil. Good to be here.
Why do you think deregulation has worked for radio?
Well, deregulation, I think, has made the industry stronger in many respects. It's made us stronger with our listeners, stronger with our advertisers, and stronger in our communities. And I think that if you look back over the last 7 years, radio today offers more format diversity than ever before. We are as responsive as ever to changing listener tastes and trends in music. And we do a better job than ever in terms of serving the communities and in providing good local news coverage in the markets we serve.
Some people argue that there is a lack of local flavor on a lot of stations that are owned by big companies like yours.
They can argue it, but I think the facts disprove the point. It has become somewhat fashionable in some quarters to criticize radio over the last few years, but I think perhaps the best thing we can do is look at consumers and listeners and their reactions. And there have been several polls commissioned over the last few months. And in those polls, roughly 80% of Americans appear to be overwhelmingly satisfied with the product that radio is providing to them.
Well, how do you keep a sense of local community?
Well, all of our radio stations are programmed by local program directors who are charged with maximizing their ratings to those local audiences. And they use a lot of tools to accomplish that. They spend lots of time reviewing local research, ascertaining local community needs. They spend times, the stations that are playing new music, spend times looking at the local music scene, listening to new bands, and trying to determine what breaking artists make sense for their radio stations. And in addition, we invest more money today than ever before in local news gatherings in markets where we are the news leaders, such as Seattle, Kansas City, Buffalo, and the like.
Now, if you own roughly 100 stations in roughly 20 markets, that means you have more than one station in a lot of markets.
That's right. We have we are roughly about five or six stations in most of the markets we serve, and frankly think that that gives us the scale to provide more services to the communities than we're able to do before.
Some people would argue that having one owner own, you know, five or six stations in a market effectively narrows the number of sources of music and perspective and in the news context of, you know, an independent voices.
Well, Neil, let me give you a couple of examples to perhaps disprove that point. When we acquired our stations in Seattle, two of the stations we acquired were both essentially fungible equivalents of each other, The End and KSW, both fighting literally song by song in the same format. And at the time, we thought it made more sense to provide delineated formats to provide more choices to the listeners in the Seattle marketplace. And so one of the stations remained an alternative rock station, while the other became more of a hard rock active radio station.
I'm not familiar with the Seattle market, but one of the listeners in the old days would have said, you know, only when there were two stations, they kept each other honest.
What does that mean, though?
Well, that if one's decided it wasn't playing enough new bands or whatever it is that people liked on that radio station, they would drift to the other and force the other one to change.
But remember how our industry works. And as you know, we are very much attuned to the Arbitron ratings. And we live in a highly competitive world where people are free to spend their times listening to radio or other alternative audio and non-audio entertainment sources. And so it is essential for us to provide content which is compelling to our listeners and gets them to listen for long periods of time. And ultimately, we are fully accountable to our listeners. And if we should ever relax our standards and not provide compelling content, we'll find ourselves losing audience, losing ratings, and thereby our businesses will deteriorate.
Now, you broadcast on the public airwaves and pay no fee for the use of the air itself. And the deal always kind of was that, you know, a radio station was granted the privilege of using the public airwaves, and in return, it offered public service. Now, a lot of people would differ in their definitions of what public service is, but do you think that you have a special obligation to your communities that goes beyond just making a profit?
Well, at Entercom, we absolutely do, and as an industry, we do. Last year, the radio industry raised over $7 billion in public service to benefit America's communities. Entercom last year raised about $40 million for the communities we serve. And, for instance, in Boston, another market we're in, we are the second largest contributors to the Mass 9/11 Fund, a fund set up to benefit the victims of the 9/11 tragedies that were on those airplanes that emerged from the Boston market and were largely filled with passengers from Massachusetts communities. So yes, we consider it a profound responsibility and a privilege to be able to provide for our communities. And I think the record shows that as a company and as an industry, the American radio industry has done an enormous amount of good for the communities we serve.
David Field, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Neil.
And we'll be speaking with one of David Field's program directors later in the program. David Field is president and CEO of Entercom, which owns over 100 stations in the United States. And joining us for the rest of the program here in Studio 3A is Mark Fisher, who's long covered the radio industry, now working on a book about radio over the last 50 years, so not a short book. Mark, good to have you here on Talk of the Nation.
Great to be with you.
How has commercial radio changed? We'll just go back to 1996 and the Telecommunications Act.
Well, when the Telecommunications Act passed, it allowed companies to acquire many more stations than they'd previously been allowed to. So you now have, in large cities, as many as 8 stations in a market can be owned by one company. And in many of the big cities across the country, that company is Clear Channel Communications, which owns 1,200 of the country's stations, about 10% of the stations on the air. And what this has done is it has allowed that company and a handful of others to dominate programming in one city after another. It means they choose the formats, they choose the kind of music that you hear, and they've narrowed the kinds of programming that are available to listeners across the country. They've done this in part by eliminating, in order to pay for all of these stations, they've had to cut costs. And one of the main ways they've done that is to reduce and sometimes eliminate news coverage, and also to reduce and eliminate DJs and local broadcasters in their communities, and instead they've been able to use the new technologies to have a DJ, say, in Denver or Dallas, provide programming to smaller communities around the country.
Mm-hmm. They also, I assume, have eliminated jobs in the sales force. This is economies of scale. You have one set of sales personnel and 5 radio stations. It all goes a little quicker.
Exactly, and you have managers who used to be in charge of developing the sound for one radio station now running 3 or 4 at a time, and what they say is that it's become impossible for them to really get a sense of their community and to provide programming that's keyed to their community. Mm-hmm. So we end up with radio sounding more or less the same as you travel around the country. Just last night I was in the car late at night and listening, and it used to be that you could hear what a city sounded like when you heard the talk shows late at night, whether it was the truckers in Wheeling, West Virginia, or you know the AM stations come in really well late at night, and you could hear across the country different sounds from different places. Now you hear pretty much the same syndicated voices out of New York or Los Angeles on stations all across the country.
Well, some of that has to do with the day part, nighttime not being the most profitable time of the day for broadcasting.
That's true, and but it's true throughout the day in, as far as what the programming is. Talk radio has been probably the greatest growth format in commercial radio in the last 10, 20 years. Mm-hmm. And what's happened most recently is that satellite technology and corporate consolidation have combined to allow stations to jettison their local programming and replace it with much less expensive national syndicated programming.
Let's get our listeners involved. This is an issue that concerns all of you. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Elizabeth joins us from Apex, North Carolina.
Hi there. I actually wanted to tell you, I have a bachelor's degree in mass communication from Auburn University, as well as a master's in communication, so I'm at least a little bit studied in the area of radio. And I think that most people forget the fact that radio stations are in business, with the exception of NPR.
We're talking about non-commercial later, but go ahead.
Right. But I think that most, you know, people forget that radio stations are in business to make money. That's the whole concept of business, and I think it's unfair to saddle them with the, I'm not sure the word I can think of, but calling it public service for them to display news and that sort of thing. Yes, it is, but it's almost impossible for them to do that fairly and still make money all the time.
Well, broadcasting has been an extremely profitable business throughout the last half century, and it has gone through different periods where national programming or local programming were dominant. But in both cases, station owners made a lot of money. What's happened in recent years is that we've had fewer and fewer formats. About half of the stations in the country now broadcast one of three formats, which is news and talk, or adult contemporary, which is basically pop hits, or country. And it used to be that there were many different kinds of music. What's happened is that the kind of music that is profitable, or that these companies think they can draw the most profit from on the radio, no longer matches what people want to listen to. About a third of all the recorded music that's bought in this country is jazz and classical and bluegrass and other smaller formats, and yet that's not on the radio.
Well, what about David Field's contention earlier when he was on the show? They've done surveys, and overwhelming majorities of radio listeners say they're satisfied with what they hear.
That's right, but it's also true that the radio audience in total has been declining every year for the past decade or so. Mm-hmm. And now part of that is because internet has come along and there's a lot more competition from other media.
You can listen to CDs in the car, yeah.
Exactly. And but part of it is also dissatisfaction with what's on the radio, the sameness of radio. Mm-hmm. One of the arguments the industry constantly makes is that we have more formats now than we used to. And technically they're correct, but the way they define those formats is so narrow that I defy any lay listener to define what the difference is between, say, adult contemporary and hot adult contemporary.
What about Elizabeth's other point, though, is that a lot of the same kinds of complaints are made about the restaurant industry in this country, that you can drive into any town anywhere, USA, and there's McDonald's and Burger King and Arthur Treacher's. I don't know if they still have Arthur Treacher's, but my point.
No.
And, you know, nobody says boo to them. I mean, everybody says, yeah, well, it's a terrible blandification of America, but, why
sure.
should they be different than radio?
It's a good point, and it's true of the culture at large. We see mom and pops being replaced by large corporate entities in almost any field you can point to. But broadcasting does have a special responsibility because there's a limited number of places of frequencies on the dial, and therefore the government doles those frequencies out, and in exchange, since these companies are getting those stations for free, in exchange they ask that there be some measure of public responsibility. Now, that has been defined, the definition of that responsibility has changed dramatically over the years, and the FCC has basically gotten out of the business of regulating content. So they are in part to blame for the morass of raunch that we hear on talk radio, for example.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, from what I hear in the background, you're not actively engaged in radio programming at this moment.
No, I am not. I'm actively engaged in volunteerism and mommyhood. But I do have a question for your guest. Do you not think that allowing free market to have a stronger influence by soliciting what people want in their radio station? I mean, it is important to me that my radio station provides public service. It's important to me that the companies that I patronize in my hometown and on the internet and all that do customer service. I think it's important that they give money to good causes or that they provide the information that's important.
Elizabeth, save the butt for the other side of the break, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right, stay on the line with us. We'll get the other half of Elizabeth's question in a moment. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the shrinking number of radio owners in the United States and how it affects what we hear. Right now, we're focusing on commercial radio. A little later, we'll turn to non-commercial radio. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a phone call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is Mark Fisher, long covered the radio industry for The Washington Post, now working on a book about the radio industry since the advent of television. And when we left, we were talking with Elizabeth in Apex, North Carolina, and you were about to come in with the butt part of your question.
Well, it's sort of just the back end. I mean, it seems to me that allowing free market to sort of take over and unburden the radio industry from you must do this public service, you have to allow people running for public office to have the least expensive ad time, whatever you're talking about, it seems to me that free market can not only influence the formats of the radio station. I would love to have a bluegrass station in my area, but I'm not able to do that because I can't call that station and go, yes, this is great, I'm going to patronize your advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
And also layering on a lot of the sort of public service aspects of a radio station, it's a bit like legislating morality. It's impossible for the stations to do that with their own mindset and their own commitment, and it restricts, actually, I think, their ability to serve their customers well.
Mark Fisher?
You know, a lot of this comes down to how you define public service. I would wager that most people don't really think of contributions to the 9/11 fund as the public service that they want from their radio station. I had an interesting conversation the other day with a woman who has a station in Woodstock, Virginia. It's a mom-and-pop station, and Clear Channel came in, took over the main station in their town, and changed the format, dismissed all the local air staff and the DJs. And so this woman and her friend started up a new station, and what they've done is they've restored what they thought of as public service, which is covering the high school sports games and community events and intensive weather reports, the kinds of things that we think of as maybe old-fashioned, maybe even amateurish. I'm sure some of the people at Clear Channel would say, well, we've replaced that with a more polished and professional approach.
And people's definitions of public interest and public service can be diverse.
Oh, absolutely. And there are certainly people who I'm sure feel well served by these big corporate stations. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also a deep nostalgia and a current need for the kind of community service that small radio stations, particularly in small communities, have provided and still can provide when they're not forced out of the market by one owner owning most of the stations in town.
Elizabeth, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's go now to Eric, and Eric's with us from Hot Spring, Arkansas.
How are you now?
Okay.
I've had a comment and from personal experience. I'm a DJ at an individually owned radio station, privately owned, and in the market that my station is in, Clear Channel, came in and they, of course, own several stations there already, a large stable of stations. They shut down a classic rock station that had been a local staple since 1969. It was KKAG, been there forever. They shut it down and they reopened it as an exact clone of our station. Every show that we would start to do new shows to serve the community, in short order, within the same quarter, depending on where we were in the book, they would start the exact same show, the exact same format. And the problem that I had, I was selling as well at the time, selling advertising, and the problem that it posed was that it's not personal. They would pipe in, and still do, the closest approximation they could, or find somebody local to do the show, whatever the show may be, and they've cloned several. And it hearkened for me back to the whole Microsoft debacle. We're big enough to do what you do, and we have enough other resources to squash what you do. And it's horrible for our town because it's a huge musical hub for my state.
Eric, I'll leave alone the idea that since 1969 has been forever. I kind of shudder at that, but anyway.
I'm a bit young.
presumably the people who listened to whatever was there before didn't like it when that radio station went on the air, but anyway.
Well, the tactics that you describe are quite common, not only to Clear Channel and other big radio companies, but if you think about it, it's what CVS does when they come in and want to knock out some of the mom-and-pop pharmacies in an area. It's what
sure.
Borders and Barnes & Noble do when they come in and they're independent booksellers. They try to match exactly exactly the services that the local independent was providing and then undercut in price, and sometimes they would locate immediately across the street. Clear Channel does essentially the same thing when it comes into a community, and it wins.
And from the consumer's point of view, all you get out of that is a lower price.
Well, that's true, but in radio, since you're not paying for the service, the analogy doesn't quite work. What you do get with Clear Channel stations, because they have this enormous debt service to pay off, is a much heavier commercial load every hour. So you have a lot of stations now that are up in the 18 to 22 minutes per hour of advertising range, and that's certainly a change in the last 10 years or so since the Telecommunications Act.
Eric, if that's the case, can you program against the other stations' commercials just to be on the air with music when they're not?
Well, we do that. In fact, we even have a spot that says, without saying the name of the station, they say that we have, you know, such and such commercials and we talk too much. Just listen right now, and then there's a pause, so you can switch over, hear that they're running commercials, and then come back and we play music.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been, it's a cat and mouse game that way, and it plays havoc on our advertisers and mostly on the listeners. I feel that it hurts the public when you're talking about the old traditional idea that it's a service because it's broadcast.
Yeah. Okay. Eric, well, thanks very much.
There is a real question about what listeners really do prefer. Do people prefer a more polished sound of a Howard Stern, a Rush Limbaugh, a Dr. Laura, to the local guy who's talking about mm-hmm. your community? And in many cases, the ratings would say that, yes, Clear Channel's right. People do want that more polished, more professional voice coming from the big city. But there's something that's lost in the equation, and that is this contact that people have, the connection, which is a deep emotional connection that people have had with radio in this country for half a century, and that's being lost. If you talk to young people now about their connection to radio, it's just something that comes into the house. It's not, or into the car. It's not something that's deeply part of them the way it was in previous decades.
But radio's been changing forever. I mean, Fibber McGee is no longer going out with Molly. I mean, now Allen's Alley is long gone. I mean, the radio completely changed at the end of the Second World War, and presumably people wanted those national voices bringing in those soap operas and the Lone Ranger and didn't get it.
That's true. And when TV took away all the big shows and the big stars, localism wasn't something that radio did out of the goodness of its heart. They were stuck. They lost their programming to TV, so they had to come along with something new, and that was all the local programming, the high school sports, the DJs who'd show up at the record hops and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was something done out of desperation and to increase profits. Now we have a new kind of programming, national programming yet again, so the pendulum has swung back in the other direction.
Well, joining us now from the studios of 107.7 The End is Phil Manning, station manager and program director for KNDD in Seattle. And it's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. I appreciate the opportunity.
How do you respond to the arguments that program directors at stations like yours, which are owned by a big company, that you guys have no freedom to choose your playlists?
I frankly have to respond with ignorance because I have no experience with it. It flabbergasts me. I've read all these anti-radio articles, of course. I'm in love with this industry I've been in for close to 20 years now, and I read them and I laugh and I chuckle because it does not apply to me, the person. And the reason I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your large audience today is so that I can help rebuff some of these urban myths and legends about music and rock radio in particular.
Mm-hmm. So you pick the playlist for your station?
Absolutely. Always have, always will.
And
that's one of the reasons I got into radio in the 80s was music. I loved music and then had to deal with being a broadcaster and a manager of people and a strategist from there. But the pure heartfelt passion of music is why I got into radio in the 80s.
And consultants hired by Entercom, which is your owner, I mean, they don't send you lists of, well, here's a good suggestion.
No, I'm an expert at what I do, Neil. Don't mean to brag too much, but I do have a lot of experience and very confident with what I do. And we do a lot of things, both with our feet on the street and in research in Seattle, to keep our pulse on our audience. Mm-hmm. It's very, very important. In fact, most of the employees at the end are really a microcosm of the audience. They're the reason they come here. They love the music. I want to work here. It's hard for me to understand all the stuff that's been going on. I have so many examples of things, positive things from a music standpoint that I know The End has done and other stations in our
mm-hmm.
format.
Mm-hmm. Now, I assume, would you make the same argument for people in an even bigger company, a Clear Channel, for example?
Yeah, it's hard for me to speak to the Clear Channel. I do have rapport with a couple of the Clear Channel program directors in the alternative rock format, and they choose their music. To me, this comes down to being local, and if you're local, you're going to win. I know, for instance, a gentleman who programs an alternative station owned by Clear Channel in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I used to program in Pittsburgh. It is a largely, vastly different market than Seattle, Washington, as you can guess. And I know he picks music for his local market. I see his playlist every week. I speak with him. I know that market quite well also, just as I do what I do here in Seattle. You know, there is a certain West Coast sound in alternative that doesn't isn't as big on the East Coast, and vice versa. So as long as you're programming to your local market, you're going to win.
Are all of your local announcers actually there locally? I mean, or do you use the voice tracking services?
Right. No, we're live and local all the time. Local morning show with Andy Savage in the morning, and everybody here live and local because they bleed the music, and you can only hear that live and local, I feel.
Well, one of the big changes in the industry has been this move towards voice tracking, having an announcer in Dallas pretending to be live and local on the air in a bunch of cities, and sometimes it is hard to tell the difference.
Yeah, it is difficult. And I think, though, that the voice trackers, those that do it, are probably getting better at it because they're hearing the local cry and, I believe, are probably preparing their shows thusly. Mm-hmm. But I can't speak from experience, as the end is always live. And, frankly, I would say all the intercom stations in Seattle, to my knowledge, are.
Okay. And are there four or five of them?
We have eight stations here.
Eight stations in Seattle. Mm-hmm. So you dominate the market, it's fair to say.
I would say so.
Okay. And are there as many people at the radio station now as when that intercom took over? I mean, if there are fewer,
right.
Where are they?
Mm-hmm. At the end, yes, we have approximately the same. I think that we have combined efforts in a marketing scenario from having one person watch over a couple of the marketing efforts of different radio stations. But we have local program directors for each radio station here in Seattle.
Okay. We have an email from a guy named Tony Lash down the road in Portland, Oregon, who writes, I'm a professional record producer and musician who's watched as the trend of media hyper-consolidation over the past several years has all but eliminated the creative risk-taking in the entertainment business. Radio, of course, has only been one piece of this destructive puzzle, but a very large piece. 10 years ago, it was not uncommon for local bands to be exposed by a local DJ who had the freedom to take a chance and play their record. Practically unheard of today.
Yeah.
Even weekly dedicated local music shows have been eliminated. Now the only road to commercial airplay is through other large corporations on equal footing with companies like Clear Channel and Viacom. How do you respond to that?
Once again, I'm going to plead ignorance. Our radio station is very special and very unique. We have an evening jock. His name is Harms, who picks anywhere upwards of 7 songs a night to play what he wants. The End constantly has a local artist on its current playlist. In fact, it's a rule that we have in the programming department. We always have feature a local band on our quarterly New Rock First sampler, which we hand out 10,000 CDs to our listeners. We do have a local show, Sunday evenings, 8 to 10, called The Young and the Restless, and we also sponsor 1 to 2 local shows each month. Also, The End has been fortunate enough to watch the rise of a young band named Vendetta Red, a Seattle band that, based on the End's airplay, off of demos, I mean, these were not great recordings. We were so passionate about it. We put it on the air, great response, and last year they signed a 7-figure deal with Epic Records, and their new record, Between the Never and the Now, comes out at the end of June. That's local radio airplay. It's happened with our sister station in Sacramento, 98 Rock, broke Papa Roach, WAAF, another one of our sister stations in Boston, broke Godsmack years ago, and it does happen in smaller communities. For instance, there's a young band out called Evanescence, really great sound. They're from Little Rock, Arkansas, and a local radio station there played one of their songs, and Evanescence currently selling about 100,000 records a week.
Well,
those to me are ways that rock radio serves its community.
Phil Manning, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And good luck to you.
Appreciate
Phil Manning is station manager and program director for The End 107.7 in Seattle, Washington, and he was with us from the studios of commercial radio station KNDD. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Mark Fisher, I wonder, excuse me for banging the microphone. Mark Fisher, I wonder how you would respond to what we just heard from Phil Manning.
Well, it's certainly true that, especially in the larger cities around the country, there are still stations that do a lot of local programming. The problem that the FCC is up against right now is that in many of the smaller and mid-sized markets across the country, there is no one there like this Phil Manning to do that kind of local programming. Mm-hmm. The classic example that the opponents of deregulation are pointing to is happened last year in Minot, North Dakota, where Clear Channel owns all of the stations in town, and the station was the local station of Minot was not manned in any way. It was run entirely by computers on a night when there was a gas leak that was quite a dangerous situation. Local authorities called the station to try to get word out to people where they're supposed to go and what they're supposed to do, and there was no one there to take the call. Now, obviously, something went wrong there, but that's the kind of thing that can happen across the country now as you have more and more stations that are totally automated where the programming is fed in from larger cities such as Seattle.
And before you call, yes, we know there is a public station, too, in Minot, North Dakota. Anyway, let's go back to a caller. Jeff joins us on the line from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I enjoy your show. I wish I could hear it more in the evening
okay.
when I'm at home. But my question to you and your guest is, what do you think satellite radio is going to do to the quality of programming on radio available to the public? And is it going to be the same way cable has affected broadcast television?
Just before we put that to Mark Fisher, XM and Sirius are two satellite radio companies that distribute, quadzillion channels on a special receiver that's about $150. But go ahead.
Right, and you pay $10 a month, so the model is very much like cable television, and I think the impact will be fairly similar in that people who really want that diversity of programming will be able to subscribe to XM or Sirius, and there's a bluegrass channel and several country stations and a whole bunch of by-the-decade, if you want 40s music or 50s music, that sort of thing.
Most of them without commercials.
Most of them without commercials, and the programming is really high quality. It doesn't get local, of course, because this is a nationwide satellite system. So what you'll be able to, people who will want this are those who are missing their kind of music on commercial radio. And for those one-third of Americans who buy recorded music of lesser types, whether it's jazz, Broadway, classical, and so on, XM and Sirius are a real alternative, and they'll probably do well now that the car companies are very firmly behind them in putting this equipment into automobiles.
And isn't it oxymoronic that here we are with radio stations provided by the federal government, and we're supposed to get something out of it, the little guy who, you know, can't afford satellite radio, and a guy like me who likes classical and jazz. Recently in Cleveland, our classical station sold to another station on the far west side of town, and I'm on the east side. I can't even pick it up anymore. And to get that kind of programming, I'm going to have to buy satellite radio, and I shouldn't have to do that.
Jeff, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. Of course, I think he misspoke. The government doesn't provide radio stations. It does provide the public airwaves that the radio stations use to broadcast. We're talking with Mark Fisher of the Washington Post Metro section, a longtime reporter covering the radio industry, now writing a book on changes in radio since the arrival of television. When we come back from a break, we're going to shift the conversations to issues concerning non-commercial radio and how that has changed under relaxed rules and new technology. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.